Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Rena Toby. Today I'll be reading from the January-February issue of Smithsonian Magazine. The first article is written by Tony Perrottet and is titled "The Couple Who Saved China's Ancient Architectural Treasures Before They Were Lost Forever." Architectural preservation is rarely so thrilling as it was in 1930s China. As the country teetered on the edge of war and revolution, a handful of obsessive scholars were making adventurous expeditions into the country's vast rural hinterland, searching for the forgotten treasures of ancient Chinese architecture. At the time, there were no official records of historic structures that survived in the provinces. The semi-feudal countryside had become a dangerous and unpredictable place. Travelers venturing only a few miles from major cities had to brave muddy roads, life-infested inns, dubious food, and the risk of meeting bandits, rebels, and warlord armies. But although these intellectuals traveled by mule cart, rickshaw, or even on foot, their rewards were great. Within the remotest valleys of China lay exquisitely carved temples staffed by shaven-headed monks, much as they had been for centuries, their roofs filled with bats, their candle-lit corridors lined with dust-covered masterpieces. The two leaders of this small but dedicated group have taken on a mythic status in China today. The architect Liang Xisheng and his brilliant poet wife Lin Huiyin. This prodigiously talented couple, who are now revered in much the same way as Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo in Mexico, were part of a new generation of Western-educated thinkers who came of age in the 1920s. Born into aristocratic progressive families, they had both studied at the University of Pennsylvania and other Ivy League schools in the United States, and had traveled widely in Europe. Overseas, they were made immediately aware of the dearth of studies on China's rich architectural tradition. So on their return to Beijing, the cosmopolitan pair became pioneers of the discipline, espousing the Western idea that historic structures are best studied by firsthand observation on field trips. This was a radical idea in China, where scholars had always researched the past through manuscripts in the safety of their libraries, or at most, made unsystematic studies of the imperial palaces in Beijing. But with flamboyant bravado, Liang and Lin, along with a half dozen or so other young scholars in the grandly named Institute for Research in Chinese Architecture, used the only information available, following stray leads in ancient texts, chasing up rumors and clues found in cave murals, even in one case an old folkloric song. It was, Liang later wrote, like a blind man riding a blind horse. Despite the difficulties, the couple would go on to make a string of extraordinary discoveries in the 1930s, documenting almost 2,000 exquisitely carved temples, pagodas, monasteries, that were on the verge of being lost forever. Photographs show the pair scrambling among stone Buddhas and across tiled roofs. Lian Xisheng, the gaunt, bespectacled, and reserved aesthete, scion of an illustrious family of political reformers, on par with being a Roosevelt or Kennedy in the U.S., Lin Huiyin, the more extroverted and effervescent artist, often wearing daring white sailor slacks in the Western fashion. The beautiful Lin was already legendary for the romantic passion she had inspired, leaving a trail of love-lorn writers and philosophers, including the renowned Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, who once composed a poem in praise of her charms. The blue of the sky fell in love with the green of the earth. The breeze between them sighs, alas. Liang and Lin found the entire field of Chinese historical architecture, says Nancy Steinhardt, professor of East Asian art at the University of Pennsylvania. They were the first to go out, actually, and find these ancient structures. But the importance of their field trips goes beyond that. So many of the temples were later lost during the war with Japan, the Revolutionary Civil War, and the communist attacks on tradition like the Cultural Revolution, that their photos and studies are now invaluable documents, she says. The romantic pair, whose letters are suffused with a love of poetry and literature, returned most often to the province of Shaanxi. Its untouched landscape was the ultimate time capsule from Imperial China. An arid plateau 350 miles from Beijing, cut off by mountains, rivers, and deserts, Shaanxi had avoided China's most destructive wars for over 1,000 years. There had been spells of fabulous prosperity as late as the 19th century, when its merchants and bankers managed the financial life of the last dynasty, the Qing. But by the 1930s, it had drifted into impoverished oblivion, and poverty, as the axiom goes, is the preservationist's friend. Shaanxi, it was found, resembled a living museum, where an astonishing number of ancient structures had survived. One of the most significant excursions to Shaanxi occurred in 1934, when Liang and Lin were joined by two young American friends, John King Fairbank and his wife Wilma. The couples had met through friends, and the Fairbanks became regular guests at the salons hosted by Liang and Lin for Chinese philosophers, artists, and writers. It was an influential friendship. John, a lanky, sandy-haired South Dakotan, would go on to become a founding member in Sinology in the United States and an advisor to the U.S. government on Chinese policy from World War II to the 1970s. Wilma was a fine arts major from Radcliffe, a feisty New Englander in the mold of Katharine Hepburn, who would later become an authority on Chinese art in her own right and play a key role in saving Liang and Lin's work from oblivion. But in the summer of 1934, the Fairbanks were two wide-eyed newlyweds in Beijing, where John was researching his PhD in Chinese history. They eagerly agreed to meet the Liangs in Shaanxi. The four spent several weeks making forays from an idyllic mountain retreat called Fan Yang before they decided to find the remote temple of Guangsheng. Today, the details of this 1934 journey can be reconstructed from an intimate photographic diary made by Wilma Fairbank and from her memoir. The prospect of the 70 miles of travel had at first seemed trivial, Wilma noted, but it became a week-long expedition. Summer rains had turned the road to gumbo, so the antique Model T Ford they had hired gave out after 10 miles. They transferred their luggage to mule carts, but were soon forced by the soldiers of the local warlord Yang Shichan, who were building a railroad line along the only roads, to take the back trails, which were traversable only by rickshaw. When the tracks became bottomless jelly, the four were forced to walk, led after dark by a child carrying a lantern. Liang Xisheng battled on through the mire, despite his near lame leg, the result of a youthful motorbike accident. The inns en route were dismal, so they looked for alternative arrangements, sleeping one night in an empty Ming Dynasty mansion, others in the homes of lonely missionaries. Along the route, they were surrounded by peasants who stared in wonder at Liang and Lin, unable to conceive of Chinese gentry taking an interest in their rural world. Often, the histrionic Lin Huiyin would fall into black moods and complain vociferously about every setback, which astonished the stiff upper lip, waspish Wilma Fairbank. But while the diva poet could be unbearable, Wilma conceded, when she rested, she responded to beautiful views and humorous encounters with utter delight. The discomforts were instantly forgotten when the exhausted party finally spotted the graceful proportions of the Guangxing Temple one dusk. The monks allowed the Fairbanks to sleep in the moonlit courtyard, while the Liang set up their cots beneath ancient statues. Next morning, the Liangs marveled at the temple's inventive structural flourishes, created by a nameless ancient architect, and found a fascinating mural of a theatrical performance from 1326. They climbed a steep hill to the upper temple, where a pagoda was encrusted in colored glazed tiles. Behind the enormous Buddha's head was a secret staircase, and when they reached the 13th story, they were rewarded with sweeping views of the countryside as serene as a Ming watercolor. The years of field trips would ultimately represent an interlude of dreamlike contentment for Liang and Lin, as their lives were caught in the wheels of Chinese history. All explorations in northern China were halted by the Japanese invasion in 1937, which forced the couple to flee Beijing with their two young children to ever harsher and more distant refuges. There was a moment of hope after the Japanese surrender when Liang and Lin were welcomed back to Beijing as leading intellectuals, and Liang, as the father of modern Chinese architecture, returned to the United States to teach at Yale in 1946 and work with Le Corbusier on the design of the United Nations Plaza in New York. But then came the communist triumph in 1949. Liang and Lin initially supported the revolution, but soon found themselves out of step with Mao Zedong's desire to eradicate China's feudal heritage. Most famously, the pair argued passionately for the preservation of Beijing, then the world's largest and most intact walled city, considered by many as beautiful as Paris. Tragically, Mao ordered its 25 miles of fortress walls and many of its monuments destroyed, which one U.S. scholar has denounced as among the greatest acts of urban vandalism in history. The rest of their lives have a tragic aura. Lin Huiyin, who had always been frail, succumbed to a long battle with tuberculosis in 1955. And Liang, despite his international renown, was trapped in 1966 by the anti-intellectual mania of the Cultural Revolution. The frenzied attack on Chinese tradition meant that Liang was forced to wear a black placard around his neck, declaring him a reactionary academic authority. Beaten and mocked by Red Guards, stripped of his honors and his position, Liang died brokenhearted in a one-room garret in 1972, convinced that he and his wife's work had been wasted. Miraculously, he was wrong, thanks to the dramatic volte-face of China's modern history. After the death of Mao in 1976, Liang Xisheng was among the first wave of persecuted intellectuals to be rehabilitated. Lin Huiyin's poetry was republished to widespread acclaim, and Liang's portrait even appeared on a postage stamp in 1992. In the 1980s, Fairbank managed to track down the pair's drawings and photographs from the 1930s and reunite them with a manuscript Liang had been working on during World War II. The posthumous volume, An Illustrated History of Chinese Architecture, became an enduring testament to the couple's work. Today, the younger generations of Chinese are fascinated by these visionary figures, whose dramatic lives have turned them into cultural icons, almost with demigod status, says Steinhardt of the University of Pennsylvania. The dashing pair have been the subjects of TV documentaries, and Lin Huiyin's love life has been poured over in biographies and soap operas. She is regularly voted the most beautiful woman in Chinese history and will be played in an upcoming feature film by the sultry actress Zhong Ziyi of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon fame. For Chinese women, Lin Huiyin seems to have it all, says Annie Zhu, Lin's great-granddaughter, who was raised in the United States. She's smart, beautiful, and independent, But there's also a nostalgia for her world in the 1920s and 30s, which was the intellectual peak of modern Chinese history. Since when did historical preservationists get to be so sexy? Muses Maya Lin, the famous American artist and architect who happens to be Lin Huiyan's niece. Talking in her loft studio in downtown Manhattan, Maya pointed through enormous windows at the cast iron district of Soho, which was saved by activists in New York in the 1960s and 70s. They've become folk heroes in China for having stood up for preservation, like Jane Jacobs here in New York, and they are celebrities in certain academic circles in the United States, Maya said. She recalls being cornered by elderly male professors at Yale who raved about meeting her aunt, their eyes lighting up when they spoke of her. Many people in China know more about Liang and Lin's personalities and love lives than their work. But from an architectural point of view, they are hugely important. If it weren't for them, we would have no record of so many ancient Chinese styles, which simply disappeared. Since China's embrace of capitalism in the 1980s, a growing number of Chinese are realizing the wisdom of Liang and Lin's preservation message. As Beijing's wretched pollution and traffic gridlock have reached world headlines, Liang's 1950s plan to save the historic city has taken on a prophetic value. I realize now how terrible it is for a person to be so far ahead of his time, says Hu Jinkao, the Beijing filmmaker who directed the documentary Liang and Lin in 2010. Liang saw things 50 years before everyone else. Now we say, let's plan our cities, let's keep them beautiful, let's make them work for people, not just cars. But for him, the idea only led to frustration and suffering. The situation is more encouraging in Liang and Lin's favorite destination, Shaanxi. The isolated province still contains around 70% of China's structures, older than the 14th century. And the couple's magnum opus on Chinese architecture can be used as a unique guidebook. I had heard that the most evocative temples survive there, although they take some effort to reach. The backwaters of Shaanxi remain rustic, their inhabitants unused to foreigners, and getting around is still an adventure, even if run-ins with warlords have been phased out. A renewed search for the temples would provide a rare view back to the 1930s, when China was poised on the knife edge of history, before it slid into cataclysmic wars and Maoist self-destruction. Of course, historical quests in modern China require some planning. It's one of the ironies of history that the province containing the greatest concentration of antiquities has also become one of the most polluted spots on the planet. Since the 1980s, coal-rich Shaanxi has sold its black soul to mining, its hills pockmarked with smelters and churning out electricity for the country's insatiable factories. Of the world's most polluted cities, 16 of the top 20 are in China, according to a recent study by the World Bank. Three of the worst are in Shaanxi. I had to wonder where Liang and Lin would choose as a base today. As the plane approached Taiyuan, the provincial capital, and dove beneath rust-colored layers of murk, the air in the cabin suddenly filled with the smell of burning rubber. This once picturesque outpost, where Liang and Lin clambered among the temple eaves, has become one of China's many anonymous second-tier cities, wrung by shabby skyscrapers. Other Shaanxi favorites have suffered in the development craze. In the grottos of Yonggang, whose caves full of giant carved Buddhas were silent and eerie when Lin sketched them in 1931, riotous tour groups are now funneled through an enormous new imperial-style entrance across artificial lakes and into faux palaces, creating a carnival atmosphere. But luckily, there is still a place where Liang and Lin would feel happy. Pingyao, China's last intact walled town and one of its most evocative historical sites. When the pair was traveling in the 1930s, dozens and dozens of these impressive fortress towns were scattered across the Shaanxi Plains. In fact, according to the Imperial Encyclopedia of the 14th century, there were 4,478 walled towns in China at one time. But one by one, their defenses were knocked down after the revolution as symbols of the feudal past. Ping Yao survived only because authorities in the poor district lacked the resources to topple its formidable fortifications, which are up to 39 feet thick, 33 feet high, and topped with 72 watchtowers. The crenellated bastions dating from 1370 also enclosed a thriving ancient town, its lane ways lined with lavish mansions, temples, and banks dating from the 18th century, when Ping Yao was the Qing dynasty's financial capital. A dusty highway now leads to Ping Yao's enormous fortress gates, but once inside, all vehicular traffic is forced to stop. It is an instant step back to the elusive dream of old China. On my visit, arriving at night, I was at first disconcerted by the lack of street lighting. In the near darkness, I edged along narrow cobbled alleys, past noodle shops where the cooks were bent over bubbling cauldrons. Street vendors roasted kebabs on charcoal grills. Soon my eyes adjusted to the dark, and I spotted rows of lanterns illuminating ornate facades with gold calligraphy, all historic establishments dating from the 16th to the 18th centuries, including exotic spice merchants and martial arts agencies that had once provided protection for banks. One half expects silk-robed kung fu warriors to appear, tripping lightly across the terracotta tile roofs a la Ang Lee. Liang and Lin's spirits hover over this remote town today. Having survived the Red Guards, Ping Yao became the site of an intense conservation battle in 1980, when the local government decided to rejuvenate the town by blasting six roads through its heart for car traffic. One of China's most respected urban historians, Ruan Yisan of Shanghai's Tongji University, who met Lin Huiyin in the early 1950s and attended lectures given by Liang Xisheng, arrived to halt the steamrollers. He was given 1 month by the state governor to devise an alternative proposal. Ruan took up residence in Ping Yao with 11 of his best students and got to work, braving lice, rock-hard kang beds with coal burners beneath them for warmth, and continual bouts of dysentery. Finally, Ruan's plan was accepted, the roads were diverted, and the old town of Ping Yao was saved. His efforts were rewarded when UNESCO declared the entire town a World Heritage Site in 1997. Only today is it being discovered by foreign travelers. The town's first upscale hotel, Jing's Resident, is housed inside the magnificent 18th century home of a wealthy silk merchant. After an exacting renovation, it was opened in 2009 by a coal baroness named Yang Jing, who first visited Ping Yao 22 years ago while running an export business. Local craftsmen employed both ancient and contemporary designs in the interior, and the chef specializes in modern twists on traditional dishes, such as the local corned beef served with cat's ear-shaped noodles. Many Chinese are now visiting Ping Yao, and although Professor Yuan Yisan is 82 years old, he returns every summer to monitor its condition and led teams on renovation projects. I met him over a banquet in an elegant courtyard where he was addressing fresh-faced volunteers from France, Shanghai, and Beijing for a project that would now be led by his grandson. "I learned from Liang Xisheng's mistakes," he declared, waving his chopsticks theatrically. He went straight into conflict with Chairman Mao. It was a fight he couldn't win. Instead, Ruan said, he preferred to convince government officials that heritage preservation is in their own interest, helping them improve the economy by promoting tourism. But, as ever, tourism is a delicate balancing act. For the moment, Pingyao looks much as it did when Liang and Lin were traveling, but its population is declining, and its hundreds of ornate wooden structures are fragile. The larger public buildings where admission can be charged are very well maintained, Ruan explained. The problem is, now the dozens of residential houses that make up the actual texture of Pingyao, many of which are in urgent need of repair. He has started the Ruan Yisan Heritage Foundation to continue his efforts to preserve the town, and he believes a preservation spirit is spreading in Chinese society, if gradually. The hotelier Yang Jing agrees. At first, most Chinese people found Pingyao too dirty, she said. They certainly didn't understand the idea of a historic hotel and would immediately ask to change to a bigger room, then leave after one night. They wanted somewhere like a Hilton with a big shiny bathroom. She added with a smile, but it has been slowly changing. People are tired of Chinese cities that all look the same. Poring over Liang and Lin's illustrated history, I drew up a map of the couple's greatest discoveries. While Shaanxi is little visited by travelers, its rural villages seem to have fallen off the charts entirely. Nobody in Pingyao had ever heard of the temples I spoke about, although they were included on detailed road charts. So I was forced to cajole wary drivers to take me to visit the most sacred forgotten spots. Some, like the so-called Muta, China's tallest wooden pagoda dating from 1056, were easy to locate. The highway south of Datong runs alongside it, so it still rises gracefully over the semi-suburban farmland. Others, like the Guangxing Temple, which Liang and Lin visited with the Fairbanks in 1934, involved a more concerted effort. It lies in the hills near Linfen, now one of the most toxic of Shaanxi's coal outposts. Much of the landscape is now completely disguised by industry. Mountains are stripped bare. Highways are clogged with coal trucks. Back in 1934, Lin Huiyan had written, "When we arrive in Shaanxi, the azure of the sky was nearly transparent, and the flowing clouds were mesmerizing. The beauty of such scenery pierced my heart and even hurt a little. Today, there are no hints of azure. A gritty mist hangs over everything, concealing all views beyond a few hundred yards. It's a haunted landscape where you never see birds or see insects. Here, the silent spring has already arrived." Finally, the veil of pollution lifts as the road rises into the pine-covered hills. The lower temple of Guangsheng is still announced by a bubbling emerald spring, as it was in 1934. And although many of the features were vandalized by Japanese troops and Red Guards, the ancient mural of the theatrical performance remains. I counted 436 steps up to the hill crest, where the lovely 13-story pagoda was still gleaming with colored glazed tiles. I could glimpse that the ancient architect really had not put a landing for reasons we will never know. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February issue of Smithsonian. I'm Rena Tobey. So long, until next time.